Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by a plethora of hosts from all corners of the planet, starting with Mark Christensen, who is in, what, San Francisco?
That's right.
And back again after last week's stellar discussion of pre- and post-viz is David Strapinas. How are you, David?
I'm still quite well, thank you.
Excellent. So the film this week is not actually a new release. It's our DVD, gosh, you know, darn it, we really like this film. We think it deserves some attention, and that's Sweeney Todd. At least I say that. Am I speaking for all three of us when I say that? Mark, did you like the film?
Oh, absolutely, and it visually stunning. I mean, it's well worth us talking about it. It's also, now that I know a little bit more about it from an effects point of view, I actually have a bit more respect for it.
And I'm assuming, David, that Tim Burton's effort here gets the nod from you?
Oh, I love this movie. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I must admit, when I was watching it, I just had two words that kept on coming to mind. I'm sure I can say this. I don't know. I can't. Bloody hell. He seemed to go into some deep, deep bloody hell. Yes, so let's start with a quick notes on the film itself, just to kind of, because we have the advantage of, you know, 2020 hindsight, having the film been out for a while. So does anyone, Mark, did you have a chance to see the kind of stats on the money it made and how successful it was, and whether it was, because last week we discussed the fact that Narnia cost $200 million. I believe this one was a lot less to make.
Yeah, I think it cost around $50 million. From what I was able to find, and its domestic box office, which of course is not the true number used to measure these things, but the one that's often used just to make people settle down and feel better, is about a break even, which means it will make quite a bit of money now that it's in DVD release. And my guess is that Tim Burton films are pretty hot sellers for DVDs anyway. Something with a really strong art direction like this as well tends to, even despite that, I think, you know, I know there's resistance to a musical and B, something pretty macabre, but what the heck, it's a great film.
Now, I must admit, I totally agree with that. I mean, I was put off by it being a musical, but it did win Best Achievement in Art Direction at the Oscars in the last round of Oscars. So I guess, David, was it art direction or that kind of whole environment one of the things that you enjoyed the most? I mean, what was it that kind of drove it for you from a technical point of view, away from just the performances of the leads?
Well, I came into it being a fan of the play. Let's make no bones about it. This is not a movie with a little bit of singing about it. This is the closest thing to opera you'll probably see in English anytime soon.
Although they didn't do an operatic treatment of it at all.
It's the sound of music with slash knives and razor blades.
Yeah, what I'm saying is it's wall-to-wall singing, pretty much. It's all the storytelling is almost done almost entirely through song, and the fact it's not, there are many movie musicals where they'll go, you know, 25 minutes of dialogue and then a song, and then 25 minutes of dialogue and a song.
It wasn't as hardcore as, say, Moulin Rouge, which was definitely like just, you know, I think even more of a musical than this was, if that makes sense. But yeah, you're right. It was definitely, let's break out in song and wander around putting our hands in the air.
But if there was ever a movie that said, this movie needs to be made by Tim Burton, this is it. I mean, visually, this subject matter, the storyline, everything was perfect for Tim Burton to approach. And normally, you can look at a film that Tim Burton's done, and you can really kind of feel a heavy hand on it, almost twisting it into what he wants it to be. But this, it felt completely like a Tim Burton film, but it felt completely right for the subject matter being what it was. Visually, it was absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely amazing.
Couple things about that. I mean, first of all, I hadn't really realized it, but Tim Burton's never done a horror movie, and I mean, this is also a musical, but it is the closest thing to a horror movie he's done.
Oh, come on! There's Ed Wood, and then there's the live. This is the live action version of Nightmare Before
I wouldn't
Christmas.
Call Ed Wood a horror movie.
Sleepy Hollow was pretty scary in places. And we'll just skip over his whole Planet of the Apes thing, because that's just... Did you know that Sam Mendes was going to direct this at one stage, and Russell Crowe was going to... And I only mentioned that because David said that he couldn't imagine anybody else doing it. I just can't imagine Russell Crowe in breaking into song. I'm sorry. Just, that was a good Hollywood decision to not go that way. But, yeah, these guys have worked together, what, six times now? And I don't know... I don't like going into kind of gossip, of course, but Helen Bonham Carter is obviously either married to or going out with Tim Burton, but she was pregnant, apparently, during the making of this.
Oh.
So probably the costume department had quite a task on their hands.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, if we just focus quickly on the art direction and move on to the visual effects, because I think one is related to the other, that for me... You know, it wasn't meant to look 100% real. It looked theatrical deliberately. Would you agree with that, David?
Well, it's... go ahead, David.
Yeah, it definitely looked... it was very presented very much like a stage play would be. You know, the camera was kept on one side of the line, covering the action pretty much from one side for a lot of the scenes, which I thought worked well. And the... You know, the entire movie was filmed on a soundstage, but it didn't feel like it all the time. A lot of the quote-unquote exterior shots felt like they were exteriors, which can sometimes be difficult for movies that are filmed on a soundstage. It was handled quite well, and I also really liked the fact that even though it was a color movie, to a large extent it felt black and white. And I thought that that worked for the kind of bleak Dickens-era... London that they were going for.
And that Dickens guy's got a lot to answer for. Hey, Mark, what did you think?
Well, the black and whiteness of it is a great contrast with the flashbacks and flash forwards in the movie that are in really bright saturated colors. So story-wise, it's great. It is really true. It's all kind of blue, yellow, black and white for the most part in the current present day stuff. I think that in terms of the realism of the sets, I mean, you know, they originally were going to shoot this all on green screen, and I think it's a great study in doing a period piece relatively inexpensively, again, a $50 million movie, with great, you know, realistic, naturalistic finish to it. Like, it doesn't actually, you know, the fact about having actors on sets is they don't ever feel like they're standing in front of something they don't even see, which is, I think, the reason that Tim Burton decided to go this way. Having started down the other path and having, I mean, they did do some green screen shots and they did pull off some great, you know, full on matte paintings. It's like, I think the Old Bailey and some of the big locations like that. But for the most part, it was on a stage with a few green screen set extensions here and there. And I think that they did it to, surprisingly save some money, but also get performances. And, you know, I think I always say there's going to be a time when we all look back at the green screen era and, you know, it'll be like the thing you sort of sheepishly tell your grandchildren that actors used to have to do that, because one way or another, I think its days are numbered, although they're not numbered necessarily soon.
So we're going for the controversial episode this week, are we? All right.
We got to be a little visionary on the show, Mike.
What are you, nuts? We're going the exact opposite way. Everyone's going more green screen, more virtual sets.
Yeah, right. But nonetheless, I maintain that someday...
And as for this whole thing about the actors being able to respond... I mean, they're actors. Pretend. Imagine that there's a staircase there. How hard can it be? You're an actor.
I believe that's the voice of someone who's never done any acting.
So, now let's talk about the visual effects, because you've crossed the bridge. David, did you... visual effects, let's leave art direction behind for a second. They've obviously gone for a stylized look in that particular color palette, and... And let's face it, you know, it works. But what did you think about the visual effects in that context of, you know, like technical excellence?
Well, I think the biggest compliment I can say is I didn't notice any effects whatsoever. There's only one shot in the entire movie which I thought was a little squirrely at all. But otherwise, it was like I knew I was seeing stuff that didn't exist, but I didn't consciously go, wow, that's an effect. And... For these quote-unquote, I don't want to say quote-unquote again, invisible effects, that's the highest compliment you can pay. is that there's set extensions or gear removal or matte paintings or whatever, and you just don't notice them. You don't go, wow, that's a really nice matte painting. It's just, it's the movie. And that's the highest achievement of visual effects, is to aid in the telling of a story.
And that has to really, hats off to MPC, because it seems to be London month this month, doesn't it? But MPC did seven entire CG backgrounds where it was green screen, a la what Mark doesn't like.
Doing all green screen thing right now, so it's possible bitterness. Go ahead.
You know, the whole Old Bailey thing, right? That's an entire CG set, and if David's not noticing it, and there are like seven of these major exterior CG environments, I mean, I think everybody's going to say, okay, if you're going to burn in a furnace or have your neck slit, that somebody's doing some visual effects or special effects somewhere. But you're right, when you've got these exteriors, especially the CG environments that need to be perfectly matched to lower level, ground level sort of initial sets, then, you know, it's got to stand up. It's got to look good.
And well, I think now, it has to be said, there are a couple exceptions here. As much as I admired the so-called London assault sequence, and I know its name from our research notes, which is where we introduce, you know, street-level London having gotten off the boat at the beginning, and we see speaking of Dickensian, we see back-alley London of this mid-19th century period that they used. I mean, that... I don't want this to be a buzzkill here, because it's a really cool sequence, and the way they made it was really cool. But it did suddenly jump out as, whoa, that was the big visual effects sequence to blast off the movie, because all of a sudden we're going at, you know, 10 times speed racing through
the
alleyways.
And you're right, it was like 12 months work from MPC. But I would actually say that there wasn't anything technically wrong with MPC's implementation of that. I just think it was a flawed thing to go for such an obvious, big, impossible move that you couldn't possibly do kind of fly-around thing, because it didn't feel like it needed it at that point. You could have accomplished that with a really huge pull-up and over the top into the streets, and maybe that's been
done
before.
Which they did later, and that's a great shot. There's a pullback over London, which we should talk about a little bit. The other ones that... were obviously not meant to look completely real were from the By the Sea sequence, where she's fantasizing, you know, kind of hilariously, because he looks like he's still living in the black and white world, and everything around him is in
riot. That would have been, walking on set that day would have been a mind-numbing experience.
But I think walking on set that day would have been the most green screens in the whole movie, because I'm like, I have a, you know, this is the benefit of doing this with DVDs, but I still framed on a shot where they're having a little picnic, and I can see really clearly that they're sitting on a blanket with real grass in front of them, and then what looks like actually a completely flat matte painting of a hillside of grass, a grassy knoll behind him, and then another flat piece behind it, which they did quite a lot of. They got away with quite a lot of kind of 2.5D in this movie, which I always like. But anyway, those were, I think, deliberately a little surreal, and it totally works for the story. So, you know, you're right. In neither case are the effects artists themselves responsible for whether the work that they did suits the story or not. But I think it's worth mentioning, you know, just because, you know, we're all interested in storytelling as well as, you know, the technical realism of our effects.
But surely you get to be cut some slack when it is a dream sequence, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and they took full advantage of it, I would say.
You can possibly.
Oh yeah, it's not a knock, Mike. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah, you can possibly take some exception to like the choice that was made in the we're going to do this effect here, but I think the execution of all the effects were, except for one crane shot, I think just about perfect. There's a shot where characters go down the stairs from one building, cross the street, go into the restaurant, and until I saw that in the making of that was all green screen. There's no set there. It's just a motion control shot with the actors and a dressed ground plane. It was all computer generated. I wouldn't have known. And I'm paid to know those things. So I think the technical execution of it is pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. I think that the amount of detail that you kind of want from a Tim Burton film, like you want attention to detail, you want a certain degree of intelligent decoding of the image, because he's just not going to stick it all there in front of your nose. He, you know, the audience is kind of coming to a Tim Burton film. I don't know, maybe it's just a snobby thing, but I think that the audience actually doesn't expect a popcorn fest. It expects a little bit more of sort of literary language. And so if it had been very effectsy, even though it's staged, I think it would have failed. Being staged, as you say, like walking that line between realistic effects and a kind of theatricalness about the sort of very nature of how it was framed and presented, you know, is a tight line to walk. And I mean, it would not be a difficult thing to cross that line and have something that looked completely fake while going for something that looked completely staged.
Well, and look at how they got away with it. I mean, it's worth talking about what you have to do on the budget that they obviously had for a $50 million film, which is neither modest nor lavish. And they did things like, you know, the opening sequence with the boat coming in. They didn't do a water sim for the water coming off the prow. They had somebody at NBC, I think, went down to the Thames and shot a boat. I mean, this was in our notes, so it must be true. Shot a boat, got its wake, and they put that in. The flapping sails, apparently, 2D warps, you know, those kind of simulations that take 20 takes.
Well, the thing I love about that is I think that's kind of a solution that too many people ignore these days in visual effects. I had a situation recently where somebody was trying to do a very complex simulation of, you know, different fluids mixing together and swirling around each other and such. And I was like, well, hold on. And we went out and we got a cookie sheet, spray painted it black, put some water in there, and then put two different color paints in there and let them just mix together. We filmed it in high def, and I brought it into After Effects and was like, now we color correct it until it looks like what we want it to look like. Took a whole of about half an hour. And, you know, the younger person who had been trying to work a fluid simulation for close to 3.5 days was like, but... And sometimes the simple solutions are the right solutions, you know? Not everything has to be completely correct. Not everything has to be in total 3D. If it looks right, it is right.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I think one thing going for the visual effects team from the outset is that it was actually headed by Chaz Jarrett, who's done a bunch of stuff from MPC for Tim Burton. And so consequently, you know, I don't know Chaz personally, but I know his work. It's excellent. But more to the point, he has a really good working relationship with the director, right? And this seems to be a director that likes to have people around him that have worked with and collaborated with before. And so once you get to know a director, you know, you can do what you just described, which is take the shortcut, because you're not going to get in a meeting and get fried because they suddenly want to have a 360-degree fly around that sail that isn't going to hold up to a 2D warp. And once you kind of know a director, you can say, well, we can't do the shot exactly as you're talking about because it would be phenomenally expensive, but we can just change it here slightly and get away with it. And you're not going to, you know, be worried about being tossed off the next picture. And I certainly got the impression back in the days, we're talking about, I think, Charlotte and the Chocolate Factory, that it was a really sort of healthy kind of relationship that he has on set, Tim Burton, this is now. So I think that was good. And I think the other thing that helped them with the budget was that they did extensive previs. You know, again, if you can kind of knock some of those things out in pre-production, they cost a fraction of what they cost when you get on set.
I guess they also did a substantial amount of photographing present-day London and using HDR photogrammetry to derive some of these buildings, which they made a big book of them and had the art director select them.
Yeah, I think it's a great point you bring up there, because this was a film that, you know, if it was a technique that we should be flagging, I don't think it's green screen, I think it's photogrammetry. I think the use of real buildings for real textures, for real architectural interest is what would have been the most significant kind of single choice, and I'm speculating here, in terms of getting those visual effects done for what is, after all, a huge amount of period work. I mean, David, you, I'm sure, did you have, like, you said before you didn't see anything that really bugged you, so I assume that the buildings, you were never sort of aware of the use of effectively cards over CG models?
No, not at all. I've been in situations where having to build complete CG cities, and this is as good as anything that would appear in Spider-Man or I Am Legend or what have you. I think sometimes we don't appreciate the complexity that goes into something like building a city, you know, because it's not a centaur or a dinosaur or whatever. But doing that and pulling it off correctly is challenging, and no, it looked great. I know sometimes people say that I don't ever like anything on the show, but I this was, you know, as good as it could be.
You know, it's I've just been looking up as you were speaking when you raised that, Mark, and it was actually James Kelly who did that visual effects photography that they used for the photogrammetry, and apparently he went around getting that book together that you were referring to, that which, you know, obviously these days as soon as you put a tripod down anywhere, getting permission to photograph anything is impossible, yet alone photographing it for a Hollywood film with the requirement of it appearing in the
but
film.
Still photos you can do. Okay. It's laying down sticks with a moving camera where you get busted.
Actually, we should give a shout out to Cinefix magazine, who has an excellent story on Sweeney Todd back in the number 113 issue, which is the 10,000 BC on the cover. And there's a really good article in there. And I've often said in the past that I think Cinefix is an excellent magazine. I just dread the day that the economics of it don't stack up in this digital world. But yeah, that's certainly what I was looking up just then, that and our show notes. And I think that having that volume of reference is something that is good, even if you don't use it for photogrammetry. I remember you were talking about Moulin Rouge a moment ago, that they did the same thing. They did style books where they get huge books of iconography, elements, you know, sort of inspiring photos, period stuff, and they just build up these massive kind of Bibles that just give you a feel for the film, even though they're not telling anything about the story. And that kind of reference, that kind of visual feel, I just think works wonders. And if anyone's making a film, taking the trouble to do that is just hugely beneficial, yet alone having this for the photogrammetry. Now, David, you commented on something you didn't like, that crane shot. Was there anything you didn't like, Mark?
Well, as I said, I reacted a little bit against how, you know, the one sequence stood out as visual effects. We're not going to worry about giving away the ending of this movie here at all.
No, it's out. Yeah. It's on DVD, and anyone listening to this show is assumed to know that we spoil movies.
I think the hardest thing, maybe, well, now that's not fair to say, but a really hard thing that they pulled off here, which I was squirmy about before, you know, because I knew it was coming, was Mrs. Lovett ending up in the oven, you know, which of course in the stage version you just throw her in there and that's it. Close the door like the witch in Hansel and Gretel. But you know, in this, we watch her her demise, and they went for something that's not maybe 100% exactly how it would be if that happened, but it seemed to really work. And having now looked at it a couple more times, I'm not squirmy about it at all. Actually, I think. And actually, then when I read about how they did it, I was really impressed, where they did sample shots of, you know, torching some meat in an oven and trying different things to get some idea of what their options were.
Yeah, I think that was true. That I guess the one for me, this isn't the weirdest thing to have criticism about, but when Sweeney Todd himself gets his neck cut, there was just so much blood.
Yeah.
There was just so much stuff pouring out of his neck like a waterfall that it took me out of the film, and I just started laughing. And maybe it was meant to be slightly comical to take some of the edge off it, but it just was like absurdly bloody. I'm not saying it was absurdly bloody from somebody could write in and tell me that the human body could pump that much blood. I'm with you. But it's just, you know, like he wasn't cutting away. It's just like pouring blood over this actress beneath him. It's like, how many takes did this poor woman have to go through?
But
yeah, but come on, could we have been satisfied if there had been any less than three times the amount?
David, did you like the neck slicing action in this film?
Yeah, the two things about the blood. There's the one early on when he slits Borat's neck. I thought that was also
I have been waiting for Sasha's name to be brought up in this, because any film that has him in it is a good.
This is one of the best too.
That was quite a bit of blood coming out there. I like the fact that they just went with a practical effect with some kind of pumping mechanism that would gush out this extremely, extremely, extremely red blood. It reminded me most of all of Kill Bill.
That's right. That's what I was thinking of too. I was thinking of Grindhouse, but yeah, same diff.
Yeah.
Tarantino meets Borat. Yeah, okay. Yep. Go on.
I think it was really necessary to go overboard with it, because it's the demon barber. But you have this guy and they're singing, and if he goes and he does slits a guy's throat and it's completely realistic, it takes away the fun of the movie. While the whole story is really dark and really demented, it's cannibalism, for God's sakes. If it was treated overly realistic, I think it would have put people way, way off of the movie. So I'm glad they went overboard with it.
Well,
I'm glad they went
Tim
extra
Burton.
Extra red.
Right. I mean, it is a Tim Burton movie, so there is going to be campiness in, the high moments.
Do you know that, talking about realism, that Sacha Baron Cohen, in other words, Borat, who obviously played the rival barber, actually hired his own personal barber to teach him how to do that kind of knife work? That's how committed that actor is to his craft. The man is a god. But anyway, I'm going to leave that alone. But, okay, the one other thing I got to touch on, because I read this phenomenally interesting quote. I've forgotten where it was, but it was in the research. Somebody said, one of the visual effects guys, and it may have been Chaz, I can't remember, he said, if you're going to do a Tim Burton film, you want to have really interesting library of skies, because Tim Burton likes interesting skies. And so I'm going to throw it to you guys, starting with you, Mark. Did you feel like the environment had breathtakingly interesting skies, or is this some other phenomenon of Tim Burton's film not seen in this film?
Well, what I heard was that they went through a lot of the most interesting skies and then dialed it back to really rainy skies for this one. They trotted out the showstoppers, and I guess maybe they were upstaging the action or something. I mean, the skies were great. The rain was great, but I didn't come away from it thinking it was a movie about skies.
Well, no, but apparently he has particular, penchant for the art direction of clouds.
I would say I really noticed it actually is, again, in the By the Sea sequence, I think, because there they got to do more of a nice sunset and, variation. So I really saw it there.
David, is this a phenomenon something I'm making up, or have you been aware of this Tim Burton sky fetish?
Well, we all know you're crazy, Mike, but it's not the only sequence I noticed it. I noticed it in the dream sequence, but I also kind of noticed it in the boat, arriving. You get a good look at the skies, but everything else is very kind of closed in, and it's more about the alleyways. And I think if we had come away from the movie going, "Wow, those were awesome skies," again, somebody screwed up.
Fair, I think the very first shot in the film is a big sky tilt down, right? I mean, like, with rain, slow motion, kind of. Am I right about that?
It's the boat, right?
It's one of those things where, the fact that there's a book of awesome looking skies, where most likely it's a folder on a desktop of pics of really awesome looking skies, shows what kind of detail has to go in, the completeness that goes into any kind of visual effect shot. We always think about the glorious hero shots of a movie, but you're all these little pieces add up to give the mood, the action, the tone, the everything that goes into a film. And I think it's important to remember that there's no effect, there's no small effects, just small budgets.
So what I want to flag in just saying that it added, I think I'm picking up on Mark's point, though. I don't know you meant it this literally, Mark. You said the opening shot is a tilt down. The actual first film shot in the film is the boat. Exactly, the titles. And I was going to say that picking up on your point, David, that rarely has there been a title sequence that I thought better served the opening of the film than the title sequence of this, because, you know, a title sequence is an interesting thing, right? You've got a bunch of screen time where you're not going to have dialogue principally, not going to have actual interaction of your characters. It's the ultimate establishing shot where you have a large amount of time to fill. Now, obviously, you could do it over black, and you can do some interesting things with audio. But in this case, they just really set it up with that sky that had either snow falling and blood, or rain and blood falling. But it was almost like a cartoon animated animatic of the shot across the top of London, with the, you know, barber's pole turning and then coming in through the skylight of that of his thing, and a great kind of lightning flash, and you reveal the barber's chair. And I just thought that was, I don't know who did it, I should have looked it up, but I thought it was just a cracking piece of art direction come, I don't know, setting the tone of a film.
Yeah, I think the first title sequence I can honestly remember is, like many people, is Seven. But there's basically two directions that you can go with the title sequence. You can either go full bore with your title sequence like they did here, or you can just, you know, have the camera following along, have the score playing, and put up people's names, you know, because you have to have that list of names at the beginning of the movie often, anyway, for contractual reasons. But the, you know, doing something creative with it that draws you right into the world of the film is, I think, vital and creative, and I wish it was done more often.
I mean, this one almost gave away the plot, right? I mean, this was like, you know, went from the barber's chair to the blood going down to the sewer pipes. So
I don't think too many people come to this movie not knowing.
Well, but you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's saying something. It's not a title that is just, I don't know, I just thought it was more than nice art direction. I thought it was like really heavily giving us a good jumping off point for the first shots of the film. But maybe you already knew the story.
Well, now, I mean, we haven't seen openings like that for a few years much, and now it's all about these end title sequences, right?
Yeah, and post-end title curses for the sequel. And interestingly, in television, I've noticed, and I think somebody's written about this as well, that a lot of TV shows are now getting rid of their, you know, what I call the Gilligan's Island opener, which is the repeated piece of footage and stuff that happens, and just going straight into the action and then throwing up a kind of a single card of the name of the show, because they just don't want to lose the audience channel surfing through the titles. The theory is that if you see the titles running on television, you know what they are, so you go check out another channel and may not come back.
One of the other issues there, to completely go down a rat hole, is you know, for a half hour sitcom, it used to be 22 minutes long with 8 minutes of commercials. For a lot of sitcoms, it's now down to 18 or 19 minutes and 11 minutes of commercials. So giving up that, you know, 30 seconds of story time for a title sequence isn't worth it. You know, they'd rather use that to actually kind of get a couple more jokes in, get a little bit more character in there, and get you interested. So it has to do with a little bit of financials. So,
but I mean, you know, House and Battlestar Galactica tend to have these big, you know, Simpsons-style long opening montages, but I think I'm right in saying that a bunch of other dramas have just been cutting them out altogether. And that, but the other thing we lose with that is the jingle, which, you know, finishing that rat hole off, I miss the TV jingle. What are future generations going to yell out at trivia nights if we don't have any show jingles to start TV shows?
Well, although, do you recognize the American ones as an Australian? Like, is there a cultural gap there?
I grew up, my first true love was Samantha from Bewitched, and I knew, you know, I obviously.
But like on Seinfeld, when they joked about, Men. Did that one?
I don't know. I don't know what you're singing there. I don't even think that was.
That was
singing.
A horrible that job was... of singing. Sorry about that.
That's right.
Can we cut that? Let's cut that out.
No, I think we should definitely leave that in. No, look, I just getting back to the.
I made a new ringtone on my phone.
Getting back to the film, though, no! for a second. Getting back to the film, though, for a second, right? It is, as you say, this contractual obligation to have a large piece of footage at the beginning of the film. And score and really strong visuals are something that can do some amazing work. Having said that, I do similarly find that, I think it's Marvel has a whole montage sequence at the start of their films that I'm like, I've seen it already, I don't need to see it again.
Well, that's their credit, isn't it?
Is it?
That's their studio logo, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, do we need any more of those studio logos? There's like about 10 of them that seem to play at the beginning of every film. But I do think if you can set the mood really well, then you're doing the audience a good job. Plus, I think there is a certain amount of settling the audience down that happens, you know, when the curtains go that little bit wider and you start getting that opening sequence. It kind of...
Right. Actually, as a little side note, I don't know. I mentioned it last week when we were talking about Prince Caspian. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the El Capitan Theater here in Los Angeles. It's a theater that's owned by Disney itself. So always, you know, there's always a Disney movie playing. But for instance, when I went to see Prince Caspian there, you know, you walk in and it's the entire theater is filled with all the props and set decoration from the movie that's going to be playing. You go in and there's a guy up on at an organ playing music like you would for an old time movie show. But then he gets lowered into the floor. The lights dim. They show previews, and then the curtain goes down and goes back up. And there's a big painting of like a scene from Narnia, and then it kind of fades and there's a backlit and there's literally an actor there with a sword who comes out and he, you know, does this little silent scene, and then they set off cannons of confetti over the audience, and it's just like, and then the curtain goes down, it goes back up, and the movie opens. And it's like, if you at that point are not in the mood to see that movie, nothing will get you in the mood. And I think you know, I'm not saying that every single movie theater needs to have an acting troupe and an organist. It would be nice, but by doing this kind of heavily art-directed piece, you can really have complete control over the mood your audience is in when you actually get into the narrative. And I think that's it's a strong tool that not enough directors use.
I was going to say, when I went to El Capitan, it was to see a digital projection of The Rookie, and digital projection was still new at that stage. And they ran the entire film digitally projected and simultaneously with 35mm, so that if there was any problem with the digital, they could move a card and reveal the cinema version, because they cared about the audience so much that they just didn't want even the slightest hint of a chance of there being a problem with the digital projection. And I was just being impressed with the quality of the technical... You know what I mean? Like the technical actual projection of the film is the correct footlights, the correct ratios for the throw. It was they really took that film seriously, or any film.
To anyone who's listening, when and if you come to LA this summer for SIGGRAPH or at any opportunity, it's not a waste of time to go see a movie here in Los Angeles, because, well, we take movies very seriously here. So it is a really different experience seeing a movie at the at the ArcLight or at the El Capitan or at Man's Chinese Theater. It's we take movies pretty seriously at some of the higher end houses here. So you know, it's not a waste of an evening. Spend your $15 and see a movie projected correctly.
Is there a similar one down in Santa Monica? Is there anything like that, or is it just
not
up in Hollywood?
There's a cute one in Westwood, but Westwood Playhouse, yeah, right? What's it called?
There's the New Art, which I think is going away. I think it got bought. Most of the ones that are down that way are usually more art films. There aren't any like marquee cinemas down in the Santa Monica area. Up along Hollywood Boulevard is where really, the ArcLight is so nice. That's where DreamWorks premieres all their movies, and of course El Capitan is Disney. So if it's Sigraf, my guess is Wall-E will probably still be there. So it's definitely worth it to make the drive up to Hollywood, pay your $10 for parking, and pay your $15 to get in the door. It's money well spent.
Well, we've well moved off Sweeney Todd, especially as that's only available on DVD. But
can I just break in for a moment? I've been quiet partly because I'm just recovering from my little singing gaffe, but also because I've been researching Richard Morrison, who is apparently the creative figure, although we know it was a whole team, responsible for that opening title sequence. And I guess he's something of a... something of a legend along the lines of Saul Bass and Pablo Ferro, according to the bio that I'm reading here. And he's been doing this for like 30 years, mostly European films, but quite a long resume. So not a newbie behind that one.
No, I think it was excellent. Thanks for looking that up. And actually, while you were saying that, I was looking up what's happening at the El Capitan Theatre. And I can tell you, during Sidgraph, it will in fact be Wall-E. And it's on between June 27th, August 27th at 10, 1, 4, 7, and 9:45. And David, you'll be pleased to know that there won't be one guy with a sword. There'll in fact be about 8 different live Disney characters on a Fantasy of Lights Flights stage show in front before the film screens. So there you go. The El Capitan Theatre in Hollywood. Well, we probably should wind it up there as we're so far off... off topic, especially with my diversion, so I apologise about that, but I'll try and be better behaved next time. It's been fun talking to you guys. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Are we allowed to ask where people can find out more about you or what you're up to at the moment?
I'm in hiding. I'm in a secluded in a secret location.
Working on something that sounds awfully interesting but we can't talk about. And just to join in the completely...
No, that's the other guy. Talk to that other guy.
Yeah, David?
Yeah, I'm the one working on stuff that... can't talk about. I mean, it's no secret I work on Avatar. You can find me on Twitter. If you send a message to me, you know, at me at it, I usually respond. I help somebody with a PF track problem this week, and so find me there. I love the Twitter, and I constantly send updates over my boring life. So
actually, I will say that I'm 26 days from exiting my telecommunications purgatory. Since I left my iPhone on a ski slope.
Okay. Good. So. Good to know. And of course, you can find me at...
back on Twitter soon. Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say you can find me at fxguide.com or fxphd.com as we're just starting a new term. Okay. Well, again, thanks to our producers, our research team, and all the people at Pixel Corps that make this show happen. Until next time, on behalf of the three of us, thanks so much, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.